Jack Spierka with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we are flashing back to October 27th, 2011. This was originally episode 772, Trevor Van Hermit from Pedal to Pedal, and pedal spelled like a bicycle and petal spelled like a flower petal. And I have changed the title of the flashback for people that are just finding it today to Composting is a Small Business, which is probably a better title for this episode and has a lesson in it for you. So the whole play on words with petal to petal, Trevor was doing all his composting in a pretty cool way. He would drive around and pick up everybody's waste and then make compost out of it. And then so all the inputs were free, and then the product had only the cost of labor in it, and at the same time you're engaging your community in acquiring all this material, and in doing so you then have a customer base to sell back to, plus you're well known in the community, and the more you do, the more people willing to partake and be part of it, either as customers or providers. And that's all great. That's all wonderful. Yay! But the gimmick of riding around on a bike, I didn't say it during the interview because I don't bring people on interviews to argue with them and debate them, but I felt a lot about this like I did, if you remember the dude from 50 Ducks in a Hot Tub. When I interviewed him, my thought was, this dude's going to go broke, and he's going to have to get rid of all his ducks, which is exactly what happened. I don't know exactly what happened to Trevor, but I do know that his website doesn't exist anymore. And the last post that I can find on their Facebook page is from 2019. And in 2019, when I'm looking at what they were posting, it doesn't look like the business was actually, they were just still promoting these practices of composting and good stewardship and permaculture and everything like that. So I have a little thought on this for you if you were to emulate this business today. A very inexpensive little pickup truck and or a trailer with it would probably be a much better way to do this. Because most people own a vehicle anyway. And efficiency is the lifeblood of a business. And with our discussions with Josh Hale this week, this business model itself, I don't think is flawed. I think the execution of this business model probably led to the eventual decision not to run this company anymore. I don't know that. I haven't heard from Trevor. Honest to God, if you go one day past this episode, I'd never heard from the guy again. I mean, I don't know. And maybe it was a good business and he got tired, he got hurt, he didn't want to do it anymore, he retired. Who knows? But generally speaking, if a business is thriving and you don't want, especially a business like this, if it's thriving and you don't want to do it anymore, somebody wants to buy it. And they're not going to get rid of the name. Even if they change the name, they'll keep the old domain and forward it because the domain's $10 a year. And so you wouldn't want to lose all the value out of that. So I'm thinking this went away. And I will just tell you that I've seen a lot of businesses like this go away over the years. Of, you know, we're going to give, for every one we sell, we're going to give one to Africa. Or all these types of these socially conscious businesses. I think the way to be good as a business at being socially conscious is, number one, don't do things that hurt people. Actually follow the credo of Google that they never followed and then got rid of because it was an embarrassment. You know, just like most of the police departments have taken protect or serve off the of the car. The Google's original thing was do no evil, and they took it away. And I think the only reason you would do that is because you're going to do evil. So, you know, actually mean that when you say it. Care of earth, care of people, return of surplus. Okay, so that would be how you're socially conscious. Then be as successful as you can be under those basic permaculture-esque restrictions. And remember, those restrictions, those three ethics, are actually derived from dozens of indigenous societies that Bill Mollison collected them from and distilled them down into the most simplistic form that were common across all of them. So this is basic, innate human decency. And then as that business becomes successful, you can take any surplus capital that you want to in that business and then engage in any socially conscious activity. And one way to do that with you know, legal structures would be then you found a nonprofit. And then you fund your own nonprofit with your surplus capital, take the tax advantages of it, and put that money into a different stream. But when people try to dovetail things together, and we're not going to have any carbon footprint because we're not using a car, or some of these other things, again, like we're, for every one we sell or every two we sell, we're going to give one away. All that means is you're overcharging your customer that's actually paying a bill. That's all that means. And the problem with that isn't so much, well, you're ripping the customer off. The problem is you're squandering the profit before you actually know what you're going to do with it. And you're trying to sell something based on a back-end pledge instead of selling the value of the product. So that's my little business lesson added to this interview. So listen to this, and if it seems like something you're interested in, think about how you can do it with a low versus no ecological footprint and increase your efficiency. Because rolling around on a bicycle, pulling a trailer, probably isn't the way to do this. It just probably isn't. It will severely limit you, and you'll probably end up, you know, even if you seem somewhat successful, not making the long run. There's a lot of businesses that, as we're going through these flashbacks, you'll be able to tell the ones that ran out of efficiency and the ones that didn't. And the ones that ran with efficiency are probably still around. The ones that didn't aren't. A lot of podcasts that never successfully monetized, you don't do something that takes this much work and effort long term unless you can actually pay bills with it. This is a fundamental lesson of business that some people refuse to learn, especially some of y'all younger people. Millennials are starting to get a dose of reality. Millennials are hitting middle age, man, right? You know, us Gen Xers, we're heading into, like, collecting Social Security, some of us. We all qualify now to join AARP. Don't do that, but we do. The millennials need to stop even mentioning them as young people. They're not young anymore. They're young and 30 young, right? Okay, like, but like Gen Zs, a lot of them are where the millennials were 10 years ago now with this whole idea of everything should be a nonprofit or whatever. Now, I'm going to quote here before we drop into the old episode, Mark Shepard, who's one of the most amazing agricultural designers I've ever had the pleasure to work with, but also an astute and smart businessman. And what he said, I believe it was Permaculture Voices 2, where he said this, a nonprofit without a successful for-profit business attached to it is a professional begging organization. In other words, there's nothing wrong with a nonprofit, but if all you are is a nonprofit, if you're not spun off from a profitable entity, then all you have is give us money, please. Now, that's not what this business was. It wasn't a nonprofit, but you know, there's two types of nonprofits. There's legally structured nonprofits, and there's businesses that don't make a profit or they don't make sufficient profit. If you find out over time that your business, you're putting 90 hours a week in, and you're making less money than you would make driving a truck for Walmart, And there is no place where that business will ever, you reach the reality that's never going to scale to be more than that. It's always going to suck you that hard and deliver that little. You're going to go drive a truck for Walmart. You have to think when you're building a business about scalability. And at some point, if you're going to scale with a physical product business, especially, someone else's labor is going into the mix. And people don't work for that kind of money unless they're driven by founding a business and bootstrapping it. And that's fine for a time. I promise you, the first 1,000 hours I put into this show, I made almost nothing. But I knew where I was going with it. That's why it made sense. And it could scale without paying labor. If you have to pay labor to scale, then you have to build the ability to pay labor into your scale. And if you can't do it, you know, one day your business won't be there anyway. So take everything you can get from this business model. Take everything you can get from this interview, because it was really good. But if you're going to emulate it, emulate the parts that work and don't emulate the parts that do not work. It might even be bicycles running around in your business, but they're going to be in short duration territories. You're going to have to plan to scale, or you're going to end up not being around anymore. With that, let's go ahead and drop on back to the original episode 772, Trevor Van Hermit from Pedal to Pedal, first published on October 27th, 2011. Trevor, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jack. I'm a listener. I've been listening to you for a few months, and I'm really excited to be one of your guests.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, man. Let's can you give people just a little bit of background on who you are and how you ended up with this business?
Well, sure. I'm originally from Denver, Colorado, and I moved to Vancouver a while back because it was a kind of a better economy, a better place for young people to get jobs. Went to school for radio and ended up in the agriculture school of the University of British Columbia. And there I kind of met a lot of the people behind the agriculture scene in British Columbia. And once I moved to Victoria, which is where I live now, and there's a lot of crossover between people moving to and from Victoria and Vancouver. They're almost like sister cities in that sense. I saw this person pedaling with a bike trailer behind them with full of stinky buckets. Within a month, I was running that business. I was told that they needed a business manager, and I was running all of the aspects of that business. With my experience in agriculture, with my experience in business management, with my web design business, I'm who they wanted. So now it's my business. I could talk a little bit about what we do.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's tell folks exactly what is Pedal to Pedal, and what do you guys do, and what's unique about what you do?
Well, what's most unique about what we do is that it's entirely human-powered. So we don't use any fossil fuels. It would be a hell of a lot easier if we did, because those are some of the cheapest calories you can come up with in our society. But we use purely human energy on bicycles with bicycle trailers, and the trailers are where we put our 5-gallon buckets full of food scraps. And once we have, depending on how hardcore the cyclist is, once you have between 8 or 20 or sometimes 30 buckets full of food, then we go to a compost host, is what we call them. And all they are is they donate, essentially, or trade part of the space in their backyard for us to compost in. So we build our massive pallet bins, 4 feet by 4 feet or 5 feet by 5 feet, just huge bins, as big as we can get them and as many as we can get, because we will fill these up so quickly at this point. And what they get in exchange for that is an unlimited soil fertility coming out of that bin. So we don't actually make any money on selling the compost. Compost is actually very, very cheap. And if we were to make money selling the compost, we'd make hardly any money at all. So we make almost all of our money on the pickup end. So people will pay between $5 and $8. Some people pay $10 for a bucket pickup. And they'll often have one of those every 2 weeks. So once you get up around 400, 500 customers, the business, well, you do the math.
And what's your hook? What's making these folks willing to pay you to take away their food scraps versus throw it in the trash and have the city or the county or whatever do it?
Well, I guess the reason people do it is that because they believe in it. So we're very much reliant on people's sense that sending all that good food scraps to the landfill is the wrong thing to do. So we deal in warm feelings, really. People get no economic benefit from using a company like Pedal to Pedal. It's all a very personal, I'm doing the right thing,
it's something they believe in, and so it's following my model whenever I talk about business of selling people something they want versus what they need, so that big boys don't kill you.
Absolutely, and we do have one very large compost competitor, and another medium-sized compost competitor. We are the smallest compost show in this city, and yet we have the largest presence on the social networks because we have the heart of the people. So we never advertised that we had a Facebook page, and I personally don't care much for Facebook, but this is just an interesting fact about our company, is that we have far more visitors on our Facebook page than our other two composting competitors, because they just take their massive trucks around, and they don't have that human element like we do.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of like is counterproductive. You say you're doing composting, but if you're driving around a big diesel truck, you're using every bit as much energy as you're supposedly saving by taking stuff out of a landfill.
That's absolutely true. And these folks with the trucks cart it all the way up to the Cowichan Valley, 50 miles away, over a mountain range, and come back with empty trucks. So we're the only folks that are composting right in the city for city use. Much of it goes to city farmers in Victoria, and a lot of it goes to city gardens. So it's just a real localized, distributed model that is what the people want and the people need right now. That's what they're looking for is a company like that.
Well, I guess it sounds like your competitors are exporting the commodity, where you're keeping the commodity local.
That's right.
And you just used a very interesting word. You know, my background in technology, with computer network testing, there's a type of testing equipment you put into a network. Instead of putting it on an end device or on the end of an infrastructure, it actually exists in the network, and it's called distributed analysis. So I have a piece of test equipment out sitting out somewhere, you know, remote at a point in the network, and I can, from a workstation, access that, and it gives me a lot of flexibility from a technology standpoint. It sounds like with your compost hosts, That's what you're doing. It's like a distributed infrastructure. So instead of having to bring all your compost back to a fixed point, you have these multiple places where people are hosting the compost facility. They get something, and they can take as much as they want, because they probably never use as much as you produce with the bin. But right. That means when you have to take it somewhere else, you can use the composting station that's closest to the point of delivery. So that's got to help you. It's got to be the only way you could do it with bicycles versus trucks.
It would be very, very hard to have a central location. Plus, if you had a large central location, we're in a property bubble right now, it would be very, very expensive to have anything central. We'd have to truck it to a faraway area, and that would make pedaling it extremely difficult. So having that distributed network is very important to our business model, and it also increases the redundancy and strength of the business. We'll lose a compost host two or three times a year, but we'll get them all the time. So having one compost host lost is not a blow to the business, because two more will crop up in its place like a hydra.
It's like having a ton of small customers versus one large one. You can afford to lose them. Very, very smart from a business resiliency standpoint.
It works. It does work.
Why do you, I mean, you told us a little bit about your background, so you could probably go get a job somewhere.
Yeah.
So obviously you believe it's important to be able to financially support yourself today. with a business. And in fact, you refer to your business as a transition business.
Yeah.
You want to explain that and tell folks also why you think it's important to be taking this entrepreneurial step today?
Well, the reason I call it a transition business is because in, as I alluded to before, a low energy future where fossil fuels are not cheap like they are now, this is a method that will work. It is also a method that will work in a high energy future. Say we find that magic formula for free unlimited energy, which I believe is unlikely. No matter the energy future we have, Pedal to Pedal is a company that's not going anywhere. When our two competitors have their bottom line hurt more and more every quarter by fuel costs, that is affecting us not at all. They can raise their prices to compensate for the fuel costs, and we can raise our prices, and it goes right to the profit. So any time where you can eliminate a dependency, that increases your transition business, that increases how much of a transition business you are. So I believe in finding business models, and there are not many of them in play right now, but finding business models that work today and work in a low energy future. Now, I have another business that I run as well, and this is a far more profitable business, and that's my web design business, Fernwood Web Design, and I can charge a hell of a lot more per hour for this web design. And this is what I did at the university. I was employed as a web designer at the university, a lot more cushy job than hauling compost around. But now I do my own private practice web design. And that's essentially how I bolster my savings. I could pay all my bills off Pedal to Pedal, which is quite remarkable. But anything extra for me is coming from the web design business. So if you're going to have a transition business and it's not terribly profitable, it works to have another small business that you can run that you can, charge more for, I guess. And there may be a business term for that, but I don't know what it is. I think, did I answer all your questions?
Yeah, you did. And I mean, part of what I look at, though, with your business models are, one is a higher-yielding business with your web design.
Yeah.
But that's not as scalable because a lot of the design is you.
Absolutely.
Where you can hire any kid who believes in what he's doing and will work for minimum wage to get on a bike and haul buckets around. So it's easier to expand the business with the lower cash flow, and so it's giving you two different levels of scalability at the same time as well. You can make a design business huge, but you may not want the headaches that go with it. You may want to take select clients and be the designer, and they're paying for you, not just a website. So you have this variable approach, and it's very similar to what I do. If you have all your money coming from one faucet and the faucet gets turned off, well, you're, to put it bluntly, screwed. You know, if you have multiple faucets, multiple income streams, and one of them even doesn't fall but just drops in volume, you can still be sustainable.
That's correct. And it's the old adage that any investment advisor will tell you is to diversify. So I believe in diversifying in all aspects or many aspects of your life. I don't think my girlfriend would like me to say I'm diversifying. But in many aspects of your life.
No, that's not going to float real well for most of us anyway. But you seem like you're pretty switched on with this business stuff. So what do you think the role of business will be in the economy of the future? Because I think both of us are aware there's some major changes coming.
Well, I think business gets a bad rap because a lot of business seems to have created the problem we're in now. Large corporations like Monsanto. But if you color the entire business landscape based on the behaviors of a few companies, the banks and the large agriculture conglomerates and the pharmaceutical companies, then you're really not being fair, because business to me is just something that people do. And I always think of the Amish when I talk about starting up what my sort of business my preference of business is. And what, and the Amish do something very, very interesting. 99% of Amish businesses succeed, which is far higher than the statistics in the non-Amish, society. Now, the Amish will normally cap, they will stop growth after they are, I don't know if it's grossing or netting or earning $1 million a year. So they figure if they are taking a $1 million slice of the pie, they don't need to expand anymore because it's not going to really increase their happiness and their joy. And if I'm making $1 million a year, I'm not looking to grow either. I may be looking to sell business plan manuals and crop other businesses like mine around the nation, but I'm not looking for a bigger slice of the pie once I'm making that $1 million. As far as the role that I think business will play in the future, it will play a big role, but it's not going to be the businesses you see today.
Do you have any like particular ways do you think that maybe the business landscape will change?
Oh, very much so. It will change to be much more localized. We won't, this is all conjecture, but I don't think we're going to be seeing the large multinational conglomerate businesses having their fingers in everybody's pie that we do today. At least I hope not. I'd like to see things done on the local level. I'd like to see, we have a dairy, a group of dairy farms called Island Farms on Vancouver Island, where my city is located, that just got bought up by a massive Canadian conglomerate. I don't remember their name, but I've noticed the milk quality dropping of Island Farms milk, and that trend I'd like to see in the exact opposite direction. I'd like it to be where any farmer can market his own milk and have his own business. I want to see more businesses, not less, which is what we have today. So more business is hopefully the future that I see.
Yeah, I think a lot of times the part of the problem with how we got here is that a lot of the people that are business people, that are small, mid-sized business people, went into a model, I would say, really starting in the 80s and really heavily ramping up in the late 90s, with the goal was no longer to build a company that was a legacy that you would hand down through your family. It was build it big enough so you could sell it to somebody else. And, of course, the person you're looking to sell it to has to have deep pockets and be afraid you're going to be a competitor if you keep growing, or a competitor will gobble you up. So they were specifically manufacturing businesses to sell to large conglomerates. And I think today we're seeing a swing back where people are saying, that's really not what I want. I want something that I can own that becomes a legacy that's based on my beliefs and built in my community, my way. And I think that community can be like what you're doing in a city, or that community can actually be a virtual online community, but it's people doing business with people.
Well, sure. And I just wanted to touch on the business selling aspect. If I was offered $1 million for pedal to pedal, that would be tempting. And that's the problem, is that these deep-pocketed people who just want to grow like a cancer have a legion of very willing business owners to sell out to them. And $1 million is a lot of money, and I can do a lot with $1 million. And I'm 24 years old, and if I had $1 million, I think I could set myself up for the rest of my life. I could buy land on this very expensive island. I could do a lot. So I completely understand the temptation.
But I think the other side of it is, if you build a business to a point where it becomes fully sustainable for yourself, then you, I just had this conversation with somebody where I was being approached by a TV producer, and he was talking about, you know, I can get you in front of 2 million people and on and on and on. And I'm like, you know, but what you're doing is counter to my principles. Yeah. And what he said was, well, I have to violate my principles every day. It was actually far worse than that. I'm paraphrasing and making this guy not sound as bad as he really was.
Oh.
And I told him, I said, you know, the beauty of a truly sustainable business. And he asked me what, and I said, you never have to compromise your principles ever again. And I think that there's a case that once a business reaches a certain size, you probably don't want, I think the Amish are smart, you don't want it to get too much bigger because you lose the ability to actually control it and keep your soul in it. But on the other side, you have to grow to a certain level where the business provides your needs so that you can resist that. Because if you're struggling and somebody says, million? And you go, no. And he goes, million two? Million six? What's it going to take? Your thought is, I'll take the money and I'll go do this again. But one thing I have to caution people with if you end up in that situation, I've seen a lot of people build a business, sell it for a lot of money, and decide they're going to go do it again and never have the magic that it took to do it the first time. There's a certain magic when you build a new idea that comes from an excitement, an anticipation, an expectation that you'll probably fail and it's worth doing it anyway. And it seems like when people try to replicate that the second time around, unless it's something new, if it's like it also ran, trying to redo the same thing, I've seen them constantly never really reach the level ever again.
Mm, that's very interesting.
I mean, I can tell you, like, for instance, I worked very closely with Mark Cuban's company, Broadcast.com, before they sold it to Yahoo. And one of their audio guys, a gentleman named Patrick Seaman, walked away from that deal. He was one of the founders. He walked away with like $58 million or something like that. And he's had three or four major business ventures, and none of them have done really anything you would look at as a knockaway home run success. And I like that he's a friend. I'm not putting him down. I'm just saying it wasn't the same as having that initial group working together on something that had never been done before. And I think there's a comfort level you have with all that money where you don't have to go out and risk it because you take $58 million and you say, okay, $18 million is risk capital. I'm going to give 10, this guy's real big with like the students with needs. So you put like $10 million in charity and you take $40 million and you say, okay, that's what I'm going to live on for the rest of my life and still give it away. And there's never that fire in the belly again that I have to make this work unless you're super cause driven, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, and that is a big part of creating something new, is having that drive and that need. I have to make a living from this, and that plays a big part into how we do marketing, how the business grows. So I completely get that. I completely understand that.
I put it this way: when you're small and you're living on what you're doing, you can't afford to be stupid.
That's right. You have to
it's blunt. Let's talk about kind of your business, what your actual output is now. So your business is the model up to now that we've talked about is pretty simple. We go out, we get customers, and those customers are people that want their solid waste, their food waste, to do something productive versus stink up a landfill. You guys and yourself that pick it up. You have compost hosts, which I think is freaking brilliant. You have people that volunteer space. They get a portion of the compost. But now you have all this compost you're producing. What do you do with that?
With the compost?
The compost itself, yes. The end product.
As I mentioned before, we don't actually sell it. But we do – well, I'd like to maybe sell it, but it's not pretty enough to sell yet. And selling it really isn't nearly as profitable as picking it up. But currently we donate it to urban farmers in Victoria, as I alluded to before. One of these is called the City Farm. It's a quarter acre basically downtown, run by a girl named Angela, and she makes a living off of that quarter acre. Another one of them is a spin farming group. And if you haven't talked about spin farming on your show, it's a very interesting farming model. But
actually, I was trying to lead you there so we could talk about it.
What's that?
I was trying to lead you there with that question so we could talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, so we'll talk about it right now. These spin farmers, it's a co-op business model. So it's not a partnership. It's a three-way. So there's three people running this particular one. It's called City Harvest, and they have a network of backyards that they farm. And these backyards, much like our compost hosts, are donated in exchange for food. So that is a way for people in this property bubble we have in Canada, for farmers, urban farmers in this property bubble, to get access to land to grow food. So I think they have a quarter acre main site and a dozen smaller sites based on the spin farming model. which kind of teaches you how to maximize yield per bed, and make a living doing it, and the benefits of a cooler, and all kinds of different stuff that they've figured out for you. So the rest of it goes to them. So we never have spare compost these days because we have probably more than an acre of very high intensive food production, dependent on our compost stream. So I guess that's sort of the goodwill side of our business.
Well, it also seems like, to me, just my marketing, you know, radar going off, that
sure,
as many ways as you're touching the community, it seems like an ideal way to be able to say, yes, if we come pick your garbage up once every 2 weeks in a bucket for $5, right over there in your neighbor's yard where food's being grown that's being sold into your community is where this is going to actually end up going back to. And that's, to me, that's much more, like, people want to do the right thing environmentally and all, but they also want to be able to see, touch, taste, smell, somehow be connected with it. Where, you know, we have like a renewable energy company down in Texas. I can't remember what they're called. Green Mountain, I think. Not the coffee people. These are energy people. But you're buying energy from the grid. They're just ensuring you that of the X percentage that's done by alternative energy, you're accounting for some portion of that. That's very far away and somewhere else, where this is, you know, your neighbor is donating their garden space so that a farmer in your community can grow this food that you can go to the farmer's market and buy, and we're picking up your food and taking it over to this other neighbor who's a compost host, who then donates it back over to this neighbor who grew the food in the first place. And to me, that's something I can walk out my backyard and understand how my community's benefiting fivefold from me giving you $5 to take my banana peel away.
Very much so. And you mentioned before that it's a simple idea that we do. And I think that's where it gets its power from, is it's very easy to understand this business once you're told it. And it's almost one of those duh moments, like, why aren't there more of these? And we are the first. But I get people every month, often more than once a month, telling me that they are inspired by our business model and they want to start one up in their own city. And I always give them as much information as they want. And I spend a lot of time describing how the business works, all the pitfalls that we know of that you don't want to get into, the legal stuff, the marketing strategies I've implemented. I give that all away for free to these people because I'd like to see a pedal to pedal in every city.
Sure.
Don't call it pedal to pedal, call it something else, but it's a puzzle piece that fits so well in a space that's empty in many, many communities. So it's a niche that's easily exploitable, especially for a young entrepreneur like myself. It's something that you won't have any competition if you start this up in your city. And for people like me, with a girlfriend who needs to live in the city, it's a good compromise. If I want to do agriculture, I can just do a pedal to pedal in the city and get an immense amount of goodwill from the people here. It's a great community building thing, as you mentioned.
I cannot think of a place where it wouldn't work. I mean, just honestly, from my business model background and looking at a business model, I also see here, I mean, obviously we're talking about composting, so permaculture, you immediately start thinking about that. But I actually see it as a permaculture business. I think everybody focuses with permaculture on the aspects about growing stuff. But permaculture is a design system, and one of the keys to a permaculture design is it's not linear, it's not a line, it's a web, an interconnected web, so that if several strands in that web fail, the system still works. If I go fishing with a line and a hook, and I catch a fish, but the line gets cut, I get no fish. If I throw a net in the water, and even 40% of my lines and my net break, assuming that I'm in a place where there's fish, I'm still pulling fish out, and I'm pulling more than I would have with the line. And that's what I'm seeing here, is this interconnected web model of your business, where there's a ton of resiliency, where you can lose any customer or any supplier, and it really doesn't affect the business overall.
That's right, and we actually started up with permaculture in mind, and that is our tagline, is we are a permaculture-based collective of bicycle-loving food security activists.
Awesome.
So it's right there, the fifth word of our of our tagline is permaculture. So I implement a lot of permaculture design elements when I'm building maps, when I'm planning routes, when I'm planning where a good compost host will be. For example, build them in the valleys so that people don't have to bicycle uphill. When you're designing your routes, start at the top of the hill. You mentioned you can't think of a place where this business wouldn't work. I can think of one. Any city with a lot of hills like San Francisco would be absolutely miserable.
But here's what I would say, right? I want to minimize the use of fossil fuels.
Sure.
If I'm in a place where it's just not practical, because there has to be a realistic side of things. If I'm in a place that just isn't practical, I can put those guys on Honda Spree scooters, and those things get about 85 miles to the gallon, and I can make this work that way. There's that wheel thing. I don't know if the guy ever took off with it. It was right when I started the show. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's a wheel that goes on the front of a bicycle that has this rotary motor in it. And it gets like 185 miles to the gallon, and what holds your gas is like this, you know, the water bottles you put on a 12-speed bike. Mm-hmm. That's your gas tank, is one of those bottles, because the efficiency is so high. And even in that model, if my competitor's using a diesel truck and I'm getting 135 miles to the gallon off a bicycle, and let's say I'm only using that propulsion mechanism when I'm going upgrade,
sure,
I can still make this work. It's not what you did. But like you said, it's San Francisco, I can either do, you know, moped compost or nothing, or, you know, truck compost.
Sure, sure. And that's very true. And you could make it work. And you could even do it without gasoline if you go electric. We have all hydroelectric power here. So you could still call yourself fossil fuel free, technically, if you had an electrical. I think it's called a moped.
Yeah, they have electric mopeds, and there's a lot of people that have done a lot of really cool stuff with electric bicycles.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you really wanted to go all out and say no fossil fuels, well, if you had a solar bank charging your bicycles, now you're making your own power.
Sure.
And if you salvaged broken highway signs for the solar panels, I mean, there's all, and I think that's the big thing, is that a lot of people talk themselves out of doing a business instead of talking themselves into how to do a business.
That's right. That's right. And I guess to touch on the salvaging thing, so much of what we have are salvaged. So our trailers are actually, most of them are shopping carts with bicycle wheels attached, completely recycled. Our compost bins or pallets, which is completely recycled. We use recycled Rubbermaids for kind of leaf delivery and stuff. And I have a fleet of bicycles that I found on the side of the road. So almost everything that we run this business off of is just free crap lying around and ubiquitous stuff. So the 5-gallon pail is very, very ubiquitous item of this culture, that you can get for free very often in just raiding recycle bins. So having a business like this that just uses the scraps of society, not only for the scraps of the produce of society, not only the food scraps, but also we use scraps for infrastructure. I hope that made sense.
No, it's actually making a lot of sense. And here I thought we were going to be talking about mostly compost today, and we're talking about business, which is just awesome. But it takes me back to my comment earlier about how the guy that goes out to do the second business doesn't have the fire in his belly and whatever. Well, if you look at like your business, if it wasn't cause driven in the first place, and you had just done everything you did because it's what you had to do, and then you sold Pedal to Pedal for $2.5 million, and you put away $1.5 million, and you took $1 million into your next business venture, and you're going to do it at a bigger, better level. Well, now we don't need to go out and get a bucket out of the recycling bin. We can, you know, order a couple pallets of them in, and we're good for a year. And
right.
Then you're not going to do those things where even if the business becomes very, very successful, what I've found is as long as the heart and soul is still in the business keeps doing what made it successful. Even as you scale a business up, the new people that come into a business do things your way because if you're smart, this is totally off the subject, but if you're smart, folks, when you hire people into your business, unless it's a specialized position, if it's a position you're going to train somebody into, hire someone that never did a flipping thing like what you're going to have them do, because then they don't bring their own ideas and they do whatever the hell you tell them exactly the way you tell them because they don't know any better. You know, and then they bring innovation without replacement.
And that's very much not the way that most people look at hiring somebody. They look at whoever has the most experience. But then you're just going to butt heads, especially the smaller the business you are, the more you're going to butt heads with this new person.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm going to hire someone for your business, for instance, I don't care if you know how to make compost. I teach you that in a day.
That's right.
I don't care if you know how to put compost bins together with pallets. I can teach you to do that in a day. I don't care if you know how to garden because that's not your job in the business. You'll figure that out as we go. If I'm going to look for anything with experience, you know how to ride a bike. You're good at riding a bike. You're in good shape, and you know how to fix a bike, right? Because I don't care how you fix the bike. As long as you fix the flat tire and keep going. But when it comes to picking things up, talking to customers, all that, I want you to do things the pedal-to-pedal way, and I don't want you to do them the Joe Blow way, so I don't want to hire Joe Blow, my competitor's guy. I want to hire the guy that's going to eventually drive around with my brand tattooed on his chest.
And that's right. And I always say that we are Victoria's most loved company. And I think that that's probably true because people just love what we're doing. We get smiles and waves every single day, which really, it's very hard work doing this. And that makes it just so much easier, just having the love of the people and the folks in trucks. Don't have the love of the people in the same way.
It doesn't look much different than a garbage truck, and it probably doesn't smell much different either.
No. And you don't see the person. You see the truck. When you're on a bicycle, you see the person.
Do you guys have a lot of interaction with your customers? And when I say that, I don't mean the people you're delivering to. I mean the people you're picking up from that are paying you. Is it just you go by and grab the bucket off the curb, or is there a lot of interaction?
You do grab the bucket off of the curb in most cases, but there is a lot of interaction, yes, and part of that is what I just mentioned about you see the person, not the truck, when you see somebody doing pedal-to-pedal. We have a lot of interaction with people who aren't customers who ask what we're doing, or interaction with people who know what we're doing and say and just want to offer their support, because we've been in the newspaper several times, we've been on TV once or twice in this city. So people know about us. We have immense brand recognition in Victoria. So we probably interact. It's like that figure that when you go to a farmer's market, there's 10 times as many conversations as a supermarket. When you're on a bicycle doing compost, there's 10 times as much interaction, not just with customers, but with the people of the city. There's 10 times, it may even be higher than that, more interaction than if you're somebody in a truck. And I try to hire people who can carry on a conversation, because that's what you'll be doing a lot, and that's part of the job, is carrying on a conversation with your customers and with the people of the city, because that is our most important aspect, is that we have the love of the people of this city. That's by far our most valuable asset.
And I would imagine when you do hire somebody, it's not somebody that's like, you know, man, I went to school and I've dreamed of driving a bicycle and carrying compost for my whole life, and this is the career path I've chosen. It's more like a person that goes, well, yeah, I need a job and I need to get paid, but I also like what you're doing, and I want to be outside. I want it to, so that they actually believe in and love what you do. I remember one time when I was working for a very large corporation, this sales manager who had, you know, very few moments of brilliance, but this was one, said everybody, we had a big company get together and there was about 500 people in the room. He said, everybody in sales, raise your hand. And there was like 12 of us. And so we all raised our hand. And he goes, well, first I want you to understand, there's your infantry. And to use an old quote, never have so many owed so much to so few, because they're feeding you. And then he said, but shame on every single person in this room without your hand up, because you all should be in sales for this company. It shouldn't just be that dozen guys over there. Mm. And it sounds to me like you've built a company where you can't, if you work there, you can't help but be a salesperson. Because whenever you meet somebody, well, what do you do? And most people are like, you know, I program graphic chipsets. And unless I know what that means and like to do it too, I'm like, oh, okay, you work for Joe Blow. And it doesn't really stick with me. But if you tell me, oh, I ride around on a bicycle and pick up people's food waste for this company that does composting, and all of a sudden you're selling me, and I've asked you to.
That's right. And all of our marketing, we haven't spent a penny on marketing, except for the paper for our flyers. All of our marketing is word of mouth, which is, again, the no overhead business model, which is the business model I love. Both of my businesses have almost no overhead. I could put I could put the web design business into hibernation for 12 months because my expense is $10 a year for the domain name. So I love the no overhead business model. So word-to-word marketing, face-to-face, word-of-mouth marketing is a huge part of that. We wouldn't be in existence without that.
That sounds like an amazing business, and man, having you on the show today has just been great. I'll tell you what, I could have you back on any time, even just to discuss business principles. And how old did you say you are, Trevor?
24.
Freaking awesome, folks. So those of you that are sitting out there going, I don't know what to do, yeah, figure it out and get it done. And I think there's something to be said with the ambition that a young person brings to it as well. So, I mean, personally, I'll tell you, thank you for doing this. Because I think it demonstrates what can be done as a business person and as somebody with a social conscience about their community. If you've heard the show, you know that I'm not real concerned about global warming. I am concerned about destroying and polluting and poisoning the planet. So regardless of, you know, where we fit together on that or don't fit together on that, I think what we need to see is more commonality in actually fixing problems. And that's what it looks to me like you're doing. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Jack.
And I mean it. I'd have you back on any time you want. You want to tell people again how to get to your websites?
Yeah, it's the pedal to pedal business is just pedaltopetal.com. pedaltopetal.com. The web design business is Fernwood Web Design, and there's actually a link right at the bottom of Pedal to Pedal to that, fernwoodwebdesign.com. Fernwood is just the neighborhood I live in. And I am willing, if anybody wants to start up a business like this, you know, you're young, you have strong legs, this is it's very hard work, so be prepared for that. But if anybody wants to start up a business like this in any city that's not Victoria, because I don't want to have to, I will give you any information I can. I'll help you as much as I can in starting that up. I hope someday to sell business plan manuals on how to do this, but for now, I'm just giving all this, business advice away because I just want to see more of these in other cities because currently we're the only one in the world except for one down in Oregon that is a nonprofit and it's only an arm of a community garden, but there's nobody else doing it the way we're doing it.
Before I let you go, I want to talk about that with you if you got a few more moments. The fact that you're a for-profit business, I think we didn't, you know, it's pretty obvious from what we said, but I think that a lot of people look at something that's really environmentally conscious, really doing something good for a local community and almost always thinking, well, that has got to be a nonprofit or a low profit environment where you're actually able to pay your bills with this. You're able to make a living and you're proving that profit can be, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, profit can be noble.
That's right. Noble is a very good word for it. And I think the fact that people think that we are volunteers is horrible. And I think the fact that people think that environmentally conscious people can't make a living is terrible, which is why I find it so important to be exporting this model, this profitable model, to as many people as possible because it's not a sustainable business. It's a regenerative business, which I think Jeff Lawton was the one who made the differentiation, or it may have even been you, that sustainable is not good enough at this point, that we need people who are actually regenerative, so the opposite of consumptive. So we are a regenerative business model, and people pay us to do it, and it's amazing to be able to make a living doing this, because it lets me focus on it. So I don't have to focus on some crap job at the coffee shop so I can pay my bills. I can give all my focus to this work, which is not something that most environmental people can do. They either have to be independently wealthy, like Mr. Al Gore, or they have to have a second job.
Yeah, where if you can actually put your heart and soul into it, you can actually make a difference. And the regenerative thing, I think I've talked about it, but I think Lawton is the source of the term. And the way I've always looked at it is if you're doing anything meaningful in the world, you're creating students, either directly or indirectly, but there are things springing up in the world around what you've done where most business people are, I hate to put it this way, and most is not the right word, but a lot of small business people, especially in their first venture, the only word I can use to describe it is asshole. They really are, because they get all upset that somebody's done something emulating them. And to me, I'm like, do you know that that means you've actually succeeded? You've done something so well that someone else out there is taking your model and making it work somewhere else and reaching people you would never have reached anyway. And you're so wrapped up in this world of negative greed, which is, you know, fearing losing something you never had in the first place. They're not taking your customers away from you. They're making a larger market for us all. And to me, that is what we should all be striving for in a business. Every time I see somebody start up a podcast and then they tell me, hey, I used to listen to your show and now I'm doing my own, I'm not like, oh, man, I can't believe you compete with me. I'm like, that freaking rocks.
Yeah.
And I think there's people that are so worried that someone's going to emulate them more successfully. And I'll just say this, if you can emulate me more successfully, go ahead. Because you'll build a market of 50,000. I'm sure some of those will fall over to me too, and we'll all grow together with this. And I think, like you said earlier, there's a cap on where I want my business to be. And you probably have one too, where if I have to expand the business at the expense of my own comfort, I'm as big as it needs to be.
Well, that's right. And I don't ever want to be one of those people who work 70 hours a week. So the cap for me is how much time am I having to spend on this?
You ain't kidding.
And if it's more than 40, well, then I'm not going to do that. So I love my leisure time. I love my downtime. So that's my primary motivator.
Well, good for you, man, because when I was your age, you know, I was putting in 80 hours a week and I was proud of it. And now I look back at that and go, you were so stupid.
Yeah.
You really were. You weren't getting anything in return compared to what you get now. And I guess I learned a lot, and a lot of the life experience is helpful and all. But, you know, there were weeks where I worked 100. There was the longest week I ever worked was when I was with MCI. We had a hurricane that we had to kind of pick the pieces up after, and I worked 111 hours. And that's when I learned there's 146 or 144 hours, something like that, in a week. And it was because I did the math to see, well, how many hours did I actually sleep this week?
Yeah.
And I used to be proud of that. Now I think that's just dumb. I really do. I don't think it makes sense. And I think that if you own your own business and you do that, you're really dumb. You know, and I hate to put anybody down, but it's just like,
that's why you hire people.
That's exactly why you hire people. Or it's why you throttle your business to a point of comfort.
Mm-hmm. It's like the Amish. Build your business the Amish way, because the Amish will transition and are transitioning without even noticing what's going on around them. So build your businesses like the Amish. The Amish are incredible business people, and that's something people don't know about the Amish. And we up here have...
title, right? Build your business the Amish way. The secret to a 99% successful business launch.
99%.
Somebody's writing that right now. They just heard that and they're out there and keyboards already flying. So go with it, man. I'm not doing it.
Yeah.
I can't believe that. That's phenomenal. A 90% success rate is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling, because more than half don't make it a year.
Oh yeah, and restaurants, 10% make it and 90% fail. After the first 3 years, I think, these numbers are probably even higher in today's economy.
Well, I was actually tried to be talked into / suckered into investing in a restaurant at one time. And basically they were looking for money to save the business. And when we got down to brass tacks, it was, well, we have to save this one and build four more successful ones, and then there'll be a profit margin. I'm like, that's not a successful business.
No. No, and part of the problem of starting up your own business is that people don't have, I guess, people don't want to take a risk on an idea that isn't already being done. And if you try to do something that's already being done somewhere, it's going to be a lot harder for you. I think it was your show. You were talking about capturing that market share. That is how people start up businesses. They try to capture existing market share. But what you've done with your podcast and what I've done with Pedal to Pedal is create a new market that didn't exist before. So
when you create a market, you own it. And
that's right.
You know, That's just reality. You own the market because you're the one that created it, and anything anybody else does is an emulation of what you've already done.
That's right, and I love it when people emulate us, and I can't wait until somebody does it successfully. And the remarkable thing is that so many people want to start one up, but I haven't seen one, except for one in Kelowna, which was only done for as a seed project for a spin farming venture. I haven't seen one done to the same level as we've done it. And
That's where I cut people with it. It was my idea first. Ideas are nothing, actually.
That's right. Ideas are cheap. I have 10 ideas a day and zero of them get implemented, or maybe one get implemented.
Yeah.
Ideas are a dime a dozen. You know, we have 7 billion people on this planet, and they all are having ideas, but it's a matter of implementing them. And as another guy who was interviewing me for the paper said, an idea is 1% inspiration. And Jack, do you know what the other 99% is?
Perspiration. Yeah, absolutely.
And we do all perspiration with this job.
I think that came from Edison.
I have no idea.
I think that's who it was, either Edison or Ford is the guy that originally came up with that. But that's a great quote, one I've always loved. Well, again, man, Trevor, thanks for being with us today on the show.
Well, thanks, Jack, and I'll be on again anytime you need somebody to talk about business.
Absolutely. Love to have you back. I've actually thought about maybe in the future putting together a couple successful folks into kind of a business roundtable discussion. Would love to maybe have it on something like that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, folks. Well, with that, we're ready to wrap up, and hopefully you learned not just about sustainable gardening and composting today, but you learned something about building a business in a sustainable way as well. With that, this has been Jack Spirico along with Trevor Van Hemert.
Hemert.
Helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.